Picture this. A bleary-eyed 22-year-old stares at Excel spreadsheets at 3 a.m. in a Manhattan skyscraper, wondering if their six-figure salary justifies the soul-crushing hours. This is the world Kevin Roos infiltrated in Young Money, following eight young financial professionals over 3 years as they transformed from bright-eyed graduates into hardened Wall Street veterans. The book struck a chord with millennials questioning traditional career paths during the aftermath of the Great Recession. The fundamental question at its heart remains painfully relevant. Is the promise of wealth worth sacrificing your 20s, your relationships, and potentially your moral compass? As we'll discover, the answer is far more complex than the glossy recruitment brochures suggest. For Arjun Khan, a Queens-born son of Indian immigrants, landing a position at Citigroup represented the American dream realized. Unlike his Harvard peers, Arjun fought his way in from Fordham University during a post-financial crisis hiring freeze. His story exemplifies Wall Street's promise as an economic elevator, offering six-figure salaries to those who can endure its brutal initiation. And brutal it is. First-year analysts routinely work 100-hour weeks building financial models and creating presentations between 8 p.m. and 4 a.m. With zero control over their schedules, they cancel personal plans at a moment's notice. The physical toll is severe. Ricardo Hernandez at J.P. Morgan gained 15 pounds from desk meals, developed bloodshot eyes from sleep deprivation, and collapsed during a weekend basketball game. Most disturbing is how these punishing conditions become badges of honor. Analysts compete over who suffers most, with claims like, "I haven't slept in 3 days," serving as twisted status symbols. Far from glamorous power brokers, today's young bankers are sleep-deprived drones creating often unread presentations while being berated for formatting errors, all for a bonus that might justify their sacrifice. Several months into his immersion, Roos noticed profound transformations in his subjects. The conversion begins subtly, saying equities instead of stocks, wearing navy suits, and relocating based on seniority. Deeper psychological changes follow as analysts become isolated through blocked social media and in-building services that eliminate reasons to leave. Money gradually becomes life's primary subtext. Relationships feel increasingly transactional, and the world inside finance expands while everything outside shrinks. Jeremy Miller Reed at Goldman Sachs exemplifies this transformation. Once thoughtful, he developed a shorter temper and began mimicking his toxic boss's behavior patterns, horrifying himself when he recognized the change. Research confirms this shift. Bankers view their bodies as machines to be optimized, taking brief naps instead of proper sleep, and ignoring health concerns. Social circles narrow as non-finance friendships fade because money suddenly matters differently. The industry creates a bubble where $20,000 bonuses seem insulting despite being half the median American household income. What begins as a job gradually becomes an identity, often unrecognizable to your former self. Despite numerous diversity initiatives, Wall Street remains predominantly white and male. At Deutsche Bank, Soojin Park was the only woman besides administrative assistants in her department. During the financial crisis, female representation declined significantly, with women in finance decreasing while men increased. Black professionals face even greater challenges. J.P. Murray found just 8 black people among 200 incoming analysts at Credit Suisse. He quickly learned unwritten rules of being a black investment banker, including code switching and navigating subtle racist remarks. This homogeneity affects major market decisions. One analyst observed how her all-male team consistently undervalued female-focused retail companies because they couldn't relate to the customer base. These aren't merely social justice concerns, but business problems with financial consequences. Despite public commitments to diversity, Wall Street's power structures remain largely unchanged, creating additional burdens for those outside the traditional banker profile. For elite banking analysts, private equity represents the path to true wealth. These firms recruit analysts after just 6 months, offering both higher compensation and better work-life balance, with starting packages often exceeding $300,000. Competition is fierce. Mega funds like KKR and Blackstone typically hire only 5 to 50 analysts annually from thousands of applicants. This exemplifies Wall Street's hedonic treadmill, where desires constantly shift relative to achievements. Even after securing his dream banking job, Arjun immediately began pursuing the next level, a pattern common among young finance professionals. In private equity, ethical questions intensify. Derek Haven struggled with acquisitions that resulted in layoffs and outsourcing. His firm acquired a family-owned manufacturer, cut 30% of the workforce, and moved production to Mexico. They employed financial engineering tactics that loaded companies with debt while ensuring investors profited regardless of outcomes. We buy these little companies, put the best lawyers and consultants on it, and if it goes bankrupt, we never lose, he explained. It's a completely rigged system. Despite criticizing the system funding his lifestyle, Derek sought balance through charity work. Despite impressive compensation packages, many young analysts experience profound disillusionment. Chelsea Ball at Bank of America Merrill Lynch found herself trapped in monotonous work under hostile supervision until her boss publicly humiliated her over a minor newsletter error. At Goldman Sachs, analysts began calling headquarters Azkaban after the soul-sucking prison from Harry Potter. Even with $130,000 first-year compensation, triple what peers earned elsewhere, they couldn't muster enthusiasm for the money. Their coping progressed from complaints to marijuana use and resignation fantasies. Their disillusionment crystallized during a mushroom trip in Central Park, where they questioned money as merely a representation of human labor. Even in this altered state, Wall Street anxieties persisted. The experience revealed that astronomical compensation couldn't offset the psychological cost of their path. Money proved a poor substitute for purpose, autonomy, and connection, a lesson many learn only after sacrificing years to finance. Jeremy's departure from Goldman Sachs felt like liberation. After turning in his credentials, he told the security guard, "I'm not coming back." Walking through Lower Manhattan with tears in his eyes, he felt this was the best day of his life. His life was finally back in his own hands. Samson left the day after receiving his bonus. Walking to Goldman for the last time, he broke down crying while listening to R. Kelly's "The Storm Is Over Now." That night, he celebrated at a downtown club, visibly happier than friends had ever seen him. Others found different paths. J.P. Murray found happiness in corporate finance, despite lower pay. Chelsea left for a lower-paying job before starting her own company. Arjun recovered from burnout and found work in private equity in Brazil. Ricardo stayed at J.P. Morgan but transferred to a group with more reasonable hours. What's striking about these stories is how they describe leaving as reclaiming something essential: their time, agency, and humanity. In a culture equating financial success with personal worth, walking away from prestige requires extraordinary courage, the first step toward building a life measured not by salary, but by meaning and fulfillment.